understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am absolutely delighted to be joined by the Reverend Dr. Michael Lloyd, Principal of Wycliffe Hall and author of Cafe Theology. He also recently co-authored a brilliant new book with Rachel Atkinson called Image Bearers. Michael, we've talked in a previous episode about the sevenfold refraction of the image of God that you talk about in your book, Image Bearers. One of those sevenfold refractions that you focus on, I think might be surprising to some people, is sexuality. I mean, would you just say a little bit about what impact the image of God has on our sexuality? Because that may not be the obvious place that we go to when we're thinking of the image of God.
No, but it's there in Genesis. God made us in his image, male and female, he created us. So that seems to me to be somewhere near the center of what being made in the image of God is, or at least necessary to that reflection of God. You almost need both genders in order to reflect something of the fullness of God. And I think that part of what is going on there is from our difference, and you know, the difference between male and female is very, very difficult to define, very, very difficult to articulate, but everybody knows it at one level, and it's a call to community. It's a call to live with somebody who is other and different from how you are, and that. Is basically a way of saying be enriched, be expanded from your own categories, your own ways of being human, and be enriched by other ways of being human. So I think our sexuality is very much part of what it is to be made in the image of God. Yeah.
And what do you think that means for equality among the sexes?
Well, equality is one of the other refractions that I talk about, not least because in surrounding cultures of ancient Israel, the Babylonian and the Egyptian, they too had a doctrine of the image of God, but that was just the king, nobody else. And what the scriptures have done, what Genesis has done, is to democratize that concept and say, no, it is every single human being. Male, female, servant, maidservant, manservant, whatever, they are all made in the image of God. That's a radical, radical move in the history of human thought. And so that's absolutely basic, as is the male and female, he created them, equal. And the ways in which we have not lived that out, have been shameful in human history and in church history. And we need to rectify that structurally, but also in our own attitudes and actions.
So what does the image of God show us about the purpose of our sexuality, do you think?
Well, as I say, I think it is this call to community, that we cannot be human on our own, that our sexual urges drive us towards engagement with that which is different from ourselves. So I think that's part of it. It also actually says that sexuality is good. It's part of the purpose of God. It's a good thing. Again, the church has sometimes, to its shame, given an idea of sexuality as if it's a bit murky and mucky. It is not. It is God-given. It is God-intended. and it is part of what makes us human. So I think it is that affirmation and that call to community that are particularly how this impacts and impinges upon us.
So what does that mean, do you think, for someone who is single, either by choice or not by choice? I mean, obviously, they can still have the community element, but it may not necessarily mean the kind of, you know, meeting the end goals of their sexual urges or their sexuality.
No, that's right. And I mean, I think I think it says, first of all, that you need men and women in your life. It says that there is an enrichment to that diversity that is really significant. And secondly, I mean, I think the person of Jesus, made in the image of God and made male in his case, that he was able to live the most fulfilled human life without actual sexual encounter. And therefore, our fulfillment as human beings is not dependent upon that. Our sexuality is really important, but sexual expression, you can live an utterly fulfilled and liberating and impactful life without that. That is a possibility. And so I think it's quite a nuanced balance of things that the Christian tradition wants to say on this.
So I guess on the flip side, for someone who is in a marriage or a relationship, how can sexual desires and behaviour bring glory to God? Because as you say, that sometimes feels at odds with a Christian theology. Perhaps historically that's been the case. But you sort of argue in the book that that's not the case. It's not murky past, as you say. So how can our sexual desires and behaviour bring glory to God?
I think that one of the most profound human urges is not to be alone, not to be isolated, not to be always on the outside looking in. I think that is one of the great human fears. And what sexual expression does is it actually kind of gets you inside the other person or around the other person. It actually blurs the distinctions between you and the other person. There's a sense in which you are becoming one, as indeed the phrase from Genesis is, becoming one flesh. You don't stop being yourself, you don't stop being an individual, but you actually transcend that. So it becomes not a division, but an extension and an enrichment. That's what is going on. And that, of course, is a reflection of and an aspect of, I would say, our relationship with God, that we are taken up into God. We don't stop being ourselves, but we get transcended into this greater reality, this greater being, this greater person. So there's a real reflection. That's why so much poetry about the soul's relationship with God uses sexual imagery, because it's a very good image.
And I guess this sort of ties in with the fact that perhaps, you know, within those relationships, you feel unconditionally loved. And there was a quote that you wrote in the book where you said, "People behave best not when they're required to, but when they know themselves to be loved." Yeah. Which I think, you know, you can do that within the context of other people or perhaps within the context of God. I mean, why is that people behave better, not when they're told to, but because they know they're loved?
Yes, it's counterintuitive, isn't it? It's sometimes said of politicians that they need change, that like they're like nappies. They need change. they need changing regularly, and for the same reason. And there's a kind of sense that is how you keep somebody up to scratch. That's how you keep them on their toes. That's how you keep them performing, by constantly threatening to vote for somebody else or remove your love or your acceptance from them. But actually, I don't think that is experientially how we do change. We change when somebody loves us because we want to. We don't change when somebody tells us to because we fear we have to. There's an alignment with our desires when we're loved, and there's nothing so transformative as that.
Michael, did Jesus have a sex drive?
Yes, because he was human. And the whole doctrine of the incarnation is he was fully 100% human as well as 100% divine. And it's sometimes, I remember one commentary, reading a commentary of the story of Jesus having somebody come and wipe his feet with their hair and their tears, and asking, did he have an erection? And I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that if we have a problem with the question, it suggests we haven't taken the full humanity of Jesus seriously. Yes, but he was somebody who was completely at ease with his sexuality. You can tell that from the warm relationships that he had with women, the deep, quite physical relationships that he had with men. John with his head on his breast during the Last Supper. And particularly, I think, by the very wonderfully non-judgmental attitude he had towards those whose sexuality was particularly broken, be it the woman caught in adultery or the woman at the well. And it's really interesting that the question that the disciples ask when they come back and are shocked to see him in conversation in public with a woman alone, which would just not have been acceptable at the time. The way that one commentator translates that is, what are you after? Now, as it happens, he wasn't up to anything bad at all, but they assumed that there might be something. They assumed that he was completely full-bloodedly male in his expression of sexuality. But what actually happens there is that he does not take advantage of that situation at all. He is completely restrained and responsible in his attitude to somebody whose experience of sexuality seems to have been very different from that, seems to have been very broken and quite traumatizing. And that is that experience of male sexuality under control and expressed respectfully and trustingly is healing of her. And she goes away transformed by that non-sexual encounter with a fully sexual male person, which has not, I think, been her usual experience. And I think that is part of what we need to be. We need to be counterexamples to people's bad experience of being used, sometimes even abused, by the sexuality of others.
We need to take a short break, but before we get back to the discussion, I want to invite you to take a look at a new unbelievable course. It's called Did It Really Happen? The Birth of Jesus. Perhaps you've been asked questions about the historicity of Jesus, or maybe you have questions of your own. We've made an in-depth course with experts and theologians diving into the historical accuracy and arguments for and against the Jesus birth narratives. You will be guided through all areas of the discussion with N.T. Wright, Emil Ewing, Daryl Bock, and others. Check it out by visiting premierunbelievable.com/courses.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
There's a great line in your book where you say we desperately need Christians to reflect their Lord in his sexual safeness, which yes. I think is clearly her experience there.
Yeah.
I mean, what does that look like practically, do you think?
Oh, I think that means that we, although our sexuality is an innate part of who we are, it's only one part of who we are. And we need to treat people as whole people. We need to treat them not simply as sexual objects, but as whole subjects. We need to be interested in them intellectually and socially and in their work and in their in every area and aspect of who they are. And the sexual only makes sense in the context of the whole of life. That's why the Jewish and Christian traditions has always said that sex's proper place is in marriage, is in a place of commitment and acceptance and totality, not out of that context in one area of putting one area of life over against the others. Sometimes I think the people say, you know, when, who are justifying casual sex will say, well, why can't we, have sex with whoever we like? And the answer is, well, what is sex trying to say? If it's just a way of saying, a physical way of saying, I fancy you, of course, why shouldn't you have it with anybody? But if it's trying to say, I want our lives to be as entwined as our bodies, then it only makes sense where those lives are entwined, where there is a mutual commitment, you're going to be there the next day, the day after that, the month after that, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years down the track. And in that context, there's a real acceptance of the totality of the person in which the expression sexually makes sense, gives expression, deepens that commitment. But without that, it doesn't say what it should be saying, and it is fragmenting rather than integrating.
And so do you think that's why Jesus's sexuality was so healing? Because he saw people for their whole being rather than just as sexual objects?
I think that's exactly right, yes. And I think you see that in John 4 in the encounter with the woman at the well.
Do we have any idea why Jesus didn't marry?
No, we don't. In the book, I quote somebody, Sister Margaret Magdalene, as saying that she thinks it's because he had too much love to give, and it would have been just too intense for any one person to have been on the receiving end of. He needed to love the world, and anything else would have been too much. That's speculation, but I think it's kind of interesting speculation. But no, to be honest, we don't know why he didn't.
And I guess we've talked about sort of Jesus's approach and his sexuality, but did Jesus explicitly say much about sex?
Just before I get onto that, I mean, I think the fact that he didn't marry is actually one of the aspects of his uniqueness, his being prepared to go against social expectation. One of the uniqueness things that we were talking about earlier. Yes, he was prepared to go very much against what social convention and social mores were. Did he speak much about it? No, he didn't speak a whole lot about it. That's partly, of course, because in the Jewish context that he lived in, there wasn't a whole lot of dispute about sexual morality. There was about the social expression of that in terms of, as I say, whether you could talk to a member of the opposite sex in public, all that sort of thing. And he was very happy to go against that. But there wasn't much controversy, and therefore he didn't need to say very much. When you see the gospel being taken out into the Greek world, where sexual morality was very different, then you begin to get people like St. Paul talking about it, because it becomes an issue, and it wasn't particularly an issue in the culture of Jesus' day.
I'm perhaps asking you to put words into Jesus' mouth, so please forgive me if I'm asking you to do that, but do we have any sense of what Jesus might say about some of these topics that are just huge now around kind of gender identity and sexuality, sexual ethics? Do we have any idea what Jesus might say into some of these difficult situations?
Well, it's well, I'll have a stab at it, but they are very fraught, and I wouldn't want to claim that I would be able to articulate Jesus' view on the subject. But I think it might be to try and see gender as a gift and not as a constraint. All the gifts of God are gifts and not constraints in the end. And if they involve constraint, that's actually for our good. It's never for our diminishment. And I think in all the very difficult and real issues surrounding this, we just need to say, okay, where is the gift here in our gender and in our sexuality? Let's begin to see that as gift. I think it's really important that we remember, as we do that, how Jesus sat loose to particular social expressions of those genders, and did not see himself constrained in those ways. So there's a kind of nuanced thing here. Let's not have set ideas, too strict ideas of what is male, what is female, but let's see maleness and femaleness as gift and as enrichment and as joy. Something along those lines, I think.
Now, Jesus's lineage was hardly squeaky clean when it came to sex, was it? Would you just say a little bit about that and how that speaks to us as sort of sexually broken people?
Oh, yes. If you look at the family tree, well, it contains prostitutes like Rahab. It contains people who cheats like Jacob. It contains a whole mass of people whose sexual history is pretty unimpressive. And that's what Jesus is born into. That is what he is. You know, there's an old expression slogan almost from the early church, which is that which is not assumed is not healed. That which Jesus doesn't come into and take on himself is not actually put right. That's him coming in to a very, very warped and distorted and sometimes violent sexual history and heritage, and he lives a very different kind of sexuality within the humanity that he's been given and he's inherited. That's what gives new opportunities and possibilities to the human race, I think.
Well, and as you say in Image Bearers, Jesus was not ashamed to own those deeply sinful people as members of his own family, which I think is a really powerful thing. So I suppose as
well, he doesn't have much choice, does he? If he wants a family at all, then I'm afraid there aren't any other candidates, really.
So I guess in light of that, how do we better reflect Jesus when it comes to our own sexuality?
I think it is correcting ourselves when we're ever tempted to see our sexuality as shoddy in any way, or a constraint, a wrong kind of constraint, and an attempt to see it just as an element of our faithfulness, that our faithfulness to our partner is a reflection of our faithfulness, is part of, indeed, our faithfulness to God. And our faithfulness to our partner is going to shape the climate of our world, in the sense that it helps to make God more believable. Where people have seen fidelity in human relationships, they're more likely to be able to believe in it when it comes to divine relationships. They're more likely to be able to believe in the fidelity of God if they've seen fidelity in human beings. So we begin to make God more believable by our faithfulness to our marriage vows or to our chaste situations. I think there's something extraordinarily powerful about people being faithful to their calling, be it a married calling or a single calling.
Michael, as we finish this, how does God bring restoration to sexual brokenness?
As in everything else, it's through acceptance. That's what the woman at the well found. That's what the woman caught in adultery found. That's what people throughout history have found. It's the acceptance that is transformative. And we need to imbibe that. And I mean that almost literally. That's what goes on at a Eucharist. You are imbibing the acceptance of God. You're drinking liquid love and edible eternity. And that's one of the modes in which we receive God's acceptance, God's love, God's value, which is transformed. We then want to reflect that experience of his faithfulness with faithfulness of our own.
Michael, thank you so much.
It's a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources, and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.